Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld. That is Duke Williams and the Extremes singing about the night before the future, and the future being disclosure and the coming revelations about who and what UFOs, ETs are. And tonight's guest is someone who's been a researcher in that field, a photojournalist, someone who's worked with some of the top people in UFO research, including J. Allen Hynek, Bud Hopkins, and lots of other people. Her name is Paula Harris. Paula, thank you for being here tonight.
Well, thank you, Alan, for asking me.
Well, I'm interested in investigating the cutting edge of the UFO phenomena, and both me and you know it is a real phenomena, and it seems like this idea of disclosure is getting closer and closer to being revealed. The fact that the government has secrets and will tell the public about it seems to be coming up. Do you agree?
Well, I don't think it's going to come from the United States government. So I think it's coming from world governments. Disclosure for me is already happening. It's been happening for a long time. And I always knew it was real, Alan, because I started working with J. Allen Hynek back in 1980, from 80 to 86, and he was an astronomer, so he was a scientist. And he worked for Project Blue Book, so he had the real material. I mean, Blue Book was an Air Force-sponsored project. So I knew it was real, but in all of these 30 years, I think that disclosure will come from other world governments and from whistleblower testimony. Part of me, because I've been watching just the United States involvement, doesn't think it's going to come from any politician or any presidential announcement. It's going to come from countries releasing their files, from countries like Mexico asking, for help when they have UFO encounters with their military airplanes. Brazil just recently gave their files over to A.J. Gavard. The Ministry of Defense in England, who released thousands of pages of files. And that's
right.
Where I think disclosure is going to come from. I think it's going to come from all the people that were involved giving testimony. I don't personally see it being an announcement of any major politician.
But it does seem that countries are coming forward, England, France, Brazil, and no one is really paying attention. People have. These governments have revealed some of their top secret, and it didn't seem to change anything. So,
thing, you just said the secret word.
What?
You said people aren't paying attention. Part of me is thinking that it's partially our responsibility. And, if people are really interested, they're the ones that should call for it, for the disclosure. And I think that, and then this is just my personal opinion, there's so much going on with, the financial crisis, the personal crisis, with ecology, with the earthquakes, with all kinds of stuff that I think that UFO disclosure sometimes is the last thing people think about. So I think in a way it could be us that's not working hard enough to get it.
Except, if they really did disclose the information that UFO technology has, we wouldn't have to worry about the energy crisis and the environment. I mean, I think that would answer a lot of problems. Of course, we'd still have to clean up the environment, but we'd have a technology that would make energy efficiency just very easy.
That's why everybody wants to do it. I mean, I think that's why Paul Hellyer spoke. For sure, that's what Dr. Stephen Greer is doing. These alternative technologies, and if we haven't learned the message from the oil spill yet, I don't know what it'll take. I think that's bottom line. But the problem is, in order to use these technologies, you have to admit, number one, Roswell was real, and mm-hmm. the United States government is still calling it a mogul balloon with crash test dummies. You have to admit that. You have to admit what Colonel Corso told me personally, that we had back-engineered UFO technology. You have to admit that, and that isn't about to happen. And, You know, we have to unravel a tapestry of lies, and I think that's part of the problem. This is just my opinion.
Well, no, I agree with you, and lots of people in the exopolitics movement agree that a lot of stuff is going to come down once it's revealed that the government's been keeping a secret for over 60 years. Stephen Bassett talks about amnesty for politicians, but I don't know. I think, though, what the real problem is that it's what Whitley Strieber talks about. He's saying that our relationship with these others are so different and so bizarre that will shift our view of reality so drastically that it will be a trauma. This is what John Mack talked about, ontological shock. It's a trauma to our cognitive system, and I think that's the biggest problem that people have to deal with. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. But, you know, because a lot of people are discussing, is it worth disclosing? Is it worth, you know, our having contact? Well, my answer to that is it's too late. I mean, and when you have pilots having UFO encounters in commercial airlines, when you have contactees coming forth with their story, when you have, you know, already all of this phenomenon, it's too late. You can't uninvent it. You can't send them back. When you have a UFO over O'Hare Airport in 2007 in November, I mean, what can you do about it? You can't tell it to go home. I mean, it's there. It had, you know, people over United Airlines terminal saw it, pilots saw it. It was a real event. Well, yeah, we have a choice. We can either deal with it or close our eyes. That's the choice.
Well, we're dealing with it. People in this movement, we're saying, hey, look, it's here. It's happening. Everyone else that I meet sort of in the real world is saying, go away. What does that matter?
That's true. You know, that's what I find. You know, when I travel around the world, for my investigations and also for speaking. And when I talk to people, a lot of them say to me, you know, how does it change my life? What difference does it make? Why should I care? And that's really hard. When they ask me these questions, you know, I realize they're on a level where they don't want to deal with it. And so I really believe on a personal level, I don't talk about it anymore. If I find somebody that just doesn't want to talk about it, it's not religion, so I don't force it. But if we want to evolve as a species, if the human race wants to evolve, if it wants to change the way it does things, it's got to grow up. And I think one of the things that the ET reality helps us do and will help us do is grow up and evolve.
Yeah, I agree. So what did you had a very good interview with Paul Hellyer, the former defense minister of Canada. What did he have to say to you personally that he didn't say before?
I interviewed him in 2005 because I thought it was very important a person of his credibility would use the words UFOs are as real as the airplanes over our head. I thought that was important. Plus, he supported the exopolitics, philosophy of the extraterrestrial presence is here on Earth and it has sociological as well as political implications. So I was really concerned about, you know, the fact that he was going into this area. This year, though, he's written a book. It's called Light at the End of the Tunnel, a survival manual for the human species. And that idea of a survival manual for the human species, you know, is very powerful. So when I went there on May 7th, I asked him the obvious question. I said, what are the solutions to the problems that we have, and how does, you know, what do you see? And Paul is multidimensional. He talked about, number one, our problems are that we're hell-bent on destroying each other, and that, number two, that possibly we've got to stop the way that we operate on this planet with all the disinformation we have. And number three, he also suggested a year of peace and forgiveness in amnesty. And number four, he said that if we have contact, if we invite contact, maybe we can learn from an evolved species. And also he talked about the political and sociological implications of contact, that we need to look at it as a world, a species, not that we have just one country look at it and they be responsible for speaking for the planet, but all of the planet. It's almost like having a dialogue in the United Nations. And I think that that's the only way to address this, number one, seriously, number two, as a planet, and number three, with real, think tank type people. It was real interesting that he said this. I'm just hoping people read the book.
No, that is those are very important points, and that does legitimize the whole field that's been kept undercover for so long and laughed at and ridiculed, and someone like him coming forward, and he was the defense minister of Canada, is that his?
Yeah, he was the defense minister of Canada under Lester Pearson, but he was also vice president under Trudeau and Pierre Trudeau, so he's been around for a long time. The problem is that this is so way out. This idea of Paul's, this acceptance of the UFO phenomenon is so way out that he's gotten a lot of criticism. I mean, he's one of the real pioneers. I mean, he's taken the risk. He, and if I have to name somebody else, Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Edgar Mitchell has done more than enough an astronaut to talk about this, to try to bring it forth. I don't see what's so funny about having a UFO shut down 10 missiles with nuclear warheads over Maelstrom Air Force Base in the 1960s. And if you speak to Robert Salas and people like that, I don't think that's to be ridiculed. I think if you really wanted to take it on another level, that's a matter of national security, when something can shut down your missiles. But, I don't want to think of it as hostile, because it could be an act of peace, since these missiles had nuclear warheads.
I think if they wanted to take over the planet, they would have done it a long time ago. And every night on Coast to Coast, George Norrie's program, there's people coming forward from Bentwaters in England, military people talking about their connections with these landed crafts. So it's a fact for us. It exists. It's a reality. But there's sort of still the inertia almost in thinking that people aren't ready for this, or I don't know what's in the way. I think this is the most exciting thing that can happen to planet Earth.
Well, I want to thank you for thinking that way, and I want to thank you for having a show that will address this. But I'll give you a clue as to what might be the problem here in the States, because I worked in Europe for many years. I was in Rome for 15 years. I worked out of Rome, Italy. I wrote for the Italian newspapers and the Italian magazines. When we have a conference in Europe, we have it full of scientists, astronomers, curious people, and nobody wears a T-shirt with a little green alien, and nobody walks around with antenna, and we don't try to sell stuff. So the looking at the UFO phenomenon in Italy and France and Switzerland and so forth is looked at differently. But if you go down to Roswell, when they have the Roswell, once a year, it becomes a big party. People get dressed up as aliens. It becomes a commercialized situation. The families that go there do not know the real story. They don't, they don't take it seriously. And that's what's so hard, because we're serious speakers and serious lecturers. And a lot of it, if you commercialize and go around wearing a T-shirt and doing stuff like that, makes it, ridicule. I mean, it makes it funny. It makes it not something serious.
I know, it's ridiculous. It's totally awful. But Americans are like that anyway. They're so unintellectual compared to Europeans, But I wanted to ask you about Paul Hellyer and his history. When did he first start getting into this whole UFO idea, and what made him come forward now? But how did he get into it?
Well, actually, it was by accident. He was given some material by Pierre Junot, a friend of his, and one of the things that he sent him was Colonel Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell. And he began reading it, and he began recognizing the names in the book, and he had a family member call a four-star general here in the United States to ask if Corso was telling the truth. And the answer was, yes, Colonel Corso told the truth and more about back engineering of this technology. So then Paul began to do his own research. He began to call military people. He began to talk to contactees. He talked to Nick Pope in England. He began to do his own research by firsthand sources, which is the only way to go. You got to go to the people that were involved. And he came to the conclusion, this is real. That not only is there a possibility of alternative energy sources, he didn't feel that they were hostile. Otherwise, as you said, we would have been destroyed a long time ago, probably when we invented the atom bomb. And he thought, well, it's my responsibility. And you know, he's 85 years old. In my lifetime, to talk about it, to come forth. And actually, he's very much like Edgar Mitchell, because Edgar Mitchell has done a lot for the UFO reality, a great deal. So the thing is that, you know, these two guys, these two men, plus Colonel Corso, who's no longer with us, you know, made a sacrifice, and they're trying to address it in a very serious manner. And Paul Hellyer, you know, he's gotten some criticism, but I think the book is worth reading, because it deals with the entire planetary situation, not just UFOs.
And the book is called again what?
It's called Light at the End of the Tunnel, A Survival Manual for the Human Species.
Wow.
And it's put out by Author House, so they could go either to Amazon or authorhouse.com and read it. I mean, it's mind-blowing, the courage he has to really call a spade, to tell it like it is, and the solutions. I mean, you know, we got a lot of problems, but it's wonderful when people try to come up with possible solutions.
Right. I mean, the thing about Edgar Mitchell, though, and Paul Hellyer, neither of them have had a first-hand experience with a UFO or ETs, right? I mean,
no, neither one of them have, and neither have I, and I've been working in this area for 30 years, but it doesn't, we don't need to see to believe. I mean, it's really interesting because I was very close friends with Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who passed on. He was kind of a spokesman for the Catholic Church, and talked about the idea that the ET reality was real, that we should be listening to witness testimony, because he said whole entire religions are based on witness testimony. And he also said that if we ever went into a court of law and brought all this evidence in, absolutely the verdict would be that we're talking about a real situation.
And yet, you know, people like Stephen Hawking and Paul Davies, mainstream scientists, they refuse to look at this data, and that's awful.
Well, my feeling is, and it's really hard to deal with it if you're not retired and your money doesn't depend on it, because a lot of scientists know it's real, but they can't risk their funding, and they can't risk their jobs, and a lot of pilots at one time could not risk their jobs to report UFOs. You know, it's not popular for you to talk about this. But if you listen carefully to people like Michio Kaku, and if you listen to even Stephen Hawking, I mean, he said it might not be wise to interact with ETs, but he used the word ET. So it's like he's saying they're out there, but it might not be wise to talk to them. But even to address that, he had us talking about this for like 3 weeks. He did more positive publicity for UFOs by having us all discuss it in worldwide media, don't you think?
Yeah, no, he brought the issue to the table. It's just the way he kind of worded it, kind of gave it a sort of negative spin, which was too bad, you know, that he said stay away. He said they wouldn't be good creatures to get in contact with, or there was some kind of fear in the way he expressed that opinion, you know?
But at least he admitted they could be there. I'm thinking, well, that's like,
no,
at least he admitted they could be there. We're having a dialogue. And, you know, it's really hard to get people to talk about this.
Right, and I think people like going from Stephen Hawking to the Vatican talking about this, this is should be looked at and taken seriously. But, you know, part of the problem, I think, are the ETs themselves. You know, they come, they hang out, there's a flurry for a while, and then they're just gone for years or months or decades. I mean, there seems every decade there is a sort of flurry of sightings, but then they disappear for a while. So,
well, no, they disappear for a while here, but there's, if you study the worldwide phenomenon, for instance, the case of Antonio Uzzi, he's been photographing craft over his house for the whole entire week, this last past week.
Where's he located?
He's in Milano, Italy. And his case is incredible. There's more film footage than you can imagine, and I was with him in Mexico City. We were just recently all there in Mexico City at Jaime Maussan's conference at the World Trade Center. So Uzi was there, Antonio was there, and I said to him, look, don't you dare go outside without me, because everywhere you go, you see UFOs. So on that Saturday, we all walked over to the World Trade Center. He stops in the middle of the road, and we look up, and there are at least three craft, and the television from Mexico City was filming them. And
oh,
this
so you
is
have
just,
you have seen craft
recently.
Then? You said you haven't seen you have seen UFOs.
Absolutely. I mean, go on my website is www.paolaharris.com. And I actually, since I was with Antonio, I took my camera and filmed them too. So my pictures of these things are on there, are on my website. So the story is that if you are a researcher, you know all over the world where the sightings are. It isn't, they're there all the time. It's not that they disappear. Maybe in the United States, because the media doesn't cover it, you know, it's not on CNN. It's not on
right.
the news.
But when something like Stevensville happens, there is a flurry in the media. And that's great. And then it's like, okay, it just slowly dies out. Or the Phoenix Lights, you know, everybody's excited by it. And there's people that, you know, making films about it and keeping reminding people. But it's not consistent in the media, which is too bad, you know.
Well, you're right. It's not consistent in the media, but that's the deal, though. It doesn't mean it's not consistent there. I mean, I think what we're looking at is, if we had a mass sighting, if we had UFOs over every major airport in the world, and they were to say, look, we are here, you know, I think that it would be interpreted as a mass invasion.
Right.
And the first thing we do is shoot. And you know, I don't think they're kind of having a problem dealing with this, because if truly it is going to be like this, you know, they could be shot at, they could be it's not, there's no real easy way for them to disclose themselves. I think what they've been trying to do is go to the people, and that's where you get all these contactees, and they're not just American, they're all over the world. I dealt with the Italian ones, and some French people that have been contacted, but you know, the contact scenario is still witnesses, and they're getting messages from, so it's not necessarily they're going to the government, they're going to the people.
Right, and I heard one of your talks, and you were saying when you were living in Italy, you met people who had these hybrid children that were half ET.
Well, that's the Maurizio Cavallo case. What it was is, when I covered that case, this was a 1986 case of contact. Regular family man on a picnic in the Italian Alps. They saw a UFO. He goes home. At night, he gets the feeling that he has to go back to that mountain. He encounters these people, and they were people. They were not gray beings. And he's in contact with them for 10 years. And at one particular point, he asked to take pictures, Polaroids of them. And they said, okay, but you have to keep them until we tell you can release them. So we know that you are, you know, that you are faithful to us. And he did. And, you know, his contract was in 86, and I did the story in 2004, and he was able to show me the Polaroid pictures then.
And they looked like
people. They were people.
Well, how do you know they weren't people? I mean,
how do I know they weren't people? Because he also has film footage. He has film footage. He has over, I don't know, 60 or 70 photographs. He's in constant contact. Some of the pictures he showed me had other people in them. They were on the beach and the UFO was over their head. I mean, in the sky while they were on the beach. You know, and as far as the people, the Polaroids that he showed me, the people that, some of the pictures, the beings have very huge eyes. They have very pronounced features. They look human, but their eyes are different. And I think just having done the research that I've done, and I've talked to Timothy Good about this, about if I talked to Timothy Good about if he had thought he ever met someone, you know, from another planet, and he told me yes, and he told me his story. It was amazing. He said he was in downtown London. He had gone into a hotel. He was sitting in the hallway, a very well-defined featured gentleman came in. He said the man looked a little different. He said, Timothy Good said that he telepathically said to the man, if you are not from this planet, take your index finger and put it on the right side of your nose. The man did this. And I said to Timothy Good, well, you know, what did you do? He said, I was in shock. He says, then this man got up and walked out. And I think that, you know, from these stories and others that I've heard, a lot of these aliens are walking among us. And they just, they either have big eyes or they have different features or they look a lot like us.
This is David Jacobs' idea as well. I just heard him give a lecture. But he comes from a place of fear that they're taking over. I don't believe that, that they are here to take over. They're here to learn from us, and we're here to learn from them. Where were these beings from, the ones that these people met in Italy?
Okay, the Maurizio Cavallo story, which is on my website, he said the beings that he met came from Clarion. And the ships, he has even voice transmissions of these people, you know, audio. He said they come from the planet, from Clarion in the system of the Eagle. And then he said that when he was aboard the ships, he saw all different kinds of people. Kind of, you know, just from, they weren't, in other words, a federation. He said it looked like a federation of different people. It wasn't all one kind of being. And I've heard this before, the fact that there is a federation of people.
And so they're working to sort of slowly integrate these higher ideals into our consciousness. It's a slow process of disclosure then.
It's a very slow process. If you look at how slow it is, you know, look at really, since Roswell, we're 60 years. 60 years of going on and on with this. And you know, that's really slow. I mean, because we've had all kinds of different situations all over the world. Apart from the missile shutdowns, we've had sightings during the Cold War. You know, you've probably spoken to Robert Dean, he said we almost started World War III over this. So we have... It's been a long time where we've had this kind of contact, and the fact that it's not, overt, where they're landing and walking around and speaking to people and everything, might just mean that we're not ready, you know, as a species. You know, a lot of people believe we're not evolved enough to be able to handle contact. So
I agree with you. I mean, look what happened in Jordan recently when someone played that joke about, you know, the aliens have landed, and the whole village just freaked out, you know. It was like the War of the Worlds all over again in Jordan. Did you hear about that story?
No, I haven't, but that doesn't surprise me at all. You know, a lot of, is it possible, I'm going to ask this question, is it possible that we're just laying down the groundwork for this and we're doing the research for this, but it'll be the future generations that actually will be the ones to have open contact, the children, the people, the kids that are used to this as science fiction, they can probably swallow it easier.
Well, it'll probably just be an everyday normal reality, the same way it probably would have been impossible for people to imagine a black president, 100 years ago, right?
Absolutely. So. And then you want to go from Galileo's time to today, you know, with flying and, you know, having a space station and so forth. I mean, it'll happen. My desire, though, is, after all this work, I was hoping it would happen in our lifetime.
Well, maybe it will, because, you know, a great example is the person you work with, J. Allen Hynek. I mean, he started as an Air Force debunker of UFOs, and no one's been able to tell me what was it that converted him from a debunker to a believer.
Well, the thing is, Allen was a spiritual person, and he used to meditate. When I knew him, he used to meditate, and I think when he was doing the debunking, it was a matter of money. All this is a matter of money, too. I mean, he had 5 children and a wife to support. You know, this was a job. And that's why a lot of the scientists don't come forward, because it's, you know, they lose their money. They lose their funding. They lose their job. A lot of the people that are coming forward are retired. They don't have anything to lose. And when Allen, you know, his kids grew up and he was older, because I met him when he was 72, you know, then he can come forth. He doesn't have as much to lose. And I think the thing that changed my life and why I began doing this was the film Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And he was a consultant on that. And that movie moved me. And I'm convinced that Steven Spielberg knows something and that he's part of a Hollywood disclosure project. To slowly acclimate humanity into looking at this,
I think he's an abductee. I think it's more unconscious in Spielberg's case, where he just feels impulsed to do these type of movies, but he may not even know why. I mean, that's my feeling about Spielberg.
But in the 70s, if you study the 70s just in general, Spielberg met Uri Geller. And Uri Geller, in those days, he had a lot to do with, you know, the paranormal and the studies at SRI. And, and Uri Geller also was tested with money from the CIA, which Edgar Mitchell helped get. The psychic spying stuff, and it's all connected, because the ability to use ESP, and that's how the aliens, that's how the extraterrestrials communicate. I mean, they don't all go to school to learn languages. They're using these the sixth sense, or the use of ESP can be a real it could be a real boon to communication. In fact, in my book, I talk about the 9 protocols, and one of them is to encourage the use of extra, the ESP in children, or the sixth sense, or telepathy, intuition. I mean, we've got to use this kind of sense, and it can't just be used for psychic spying. And that makes it legit when we use it for psychic spying in the 70s, but it's not legit today.
I think it's part of our human facilities to just our basic human quality is to be psychic, to be able to remote view, to be able to even move things at will if we had enough mental training to do that. I know someone who's a mentalist who can do that.
Well, if we really did do that, we'd be opening the door to a different reality, wouldn't we? And then we could maybe let the extraterrestrial reality in.
That's why I call my program New Realities, because I know all that is a possibility that we just have to tap into. I met a guy named Mark Newkirk who's working with information fields, and he's saying these fields that surround us contain all the information, and they can be used to communicate psychically, but there's a science to it. It's not just things are psychic. We need to develop a new science that will explain these phenomena. And I think that's where we're coming into. an understanding about. But I was just curious, was there one event that happened to J. Allen Hynek that took him from skeptic to believer? Do you know?
Well, I don't think he was ever a skeptic.
Oh, even when he said it was swamp gas?
I think that he had to call, you know, citing swamp gas. That was what he was paid to do. I mean, the Air Force was not paying him to go up there and say, this is real. I think he wasn't a believer. He was open-minded. In fact, having been with him, he's the only person that I've ever been with that would listen for a long time and not say anything. And he was a great listener, so he was processing information. So I think Alan wasn't a skeptic. I think he had to play that role in order to keep that job. But
oh, really? Because it seemed like he came into it from the Air Force, you know, pretty much a non-believer in the early days, until maybe he saw enough evidence that he just couldn't dispute because he was open-minded. You know, everyone who's been orientated in this culture would be brought up to be a skeptic until they really looked at the evidence. And maybe he was just intelligent enough to let go of his conditioning.
Well, I think if he began working with Blue Book in the early days, and he did, and he's seeing pictures, and he saw some great pictures, and he sees movies, and he saw some great movies, I don't think he was skeptic. I think he knew there was something there. But he prided himself with explaining that. And, you know, he said that he could explain three-quarters of it. But he said also that the one-quarter, you know, you only need one UFO sighting to deal with this kind of situation. He said, but the one quarter that he couldn't explain was worth studying. It fascinated him. He was fascinated by it. And Alan even took pictures of UFOs. In one of his books, from an airplane window, there's Alan Hynek pictures of UFOs.
Oh. So, I mean, he was a real important part of this movement because of his position. But what about the rest of the Project Blue Book? How come he didn't blow the whistle on the whole thing?
Well,
or
it
did
would
he?
Help. I mean, I don't think it would help the situation because there's the powers that be don't want it. Like, it went to the Condon situation here at the University of Colorado where I am. I mean, can you imagine having all those pictures, all those movies, and coming to the conclusion that Condon did that it was not anything to be studied? This was in 1968. It was a way of dismissing the whole thing. In other words, it's kind of saying to the general public, look, don't worry about it. It's not that important. It isn't even something worth looking at. Let's close the door on this. The problem is that you can't. People say, why don't we forget about it? It's too late. It's too late to forget about it, and it's too late to close the door on it because we have too many of these sightings, and a lot of them are by commercial airline pilots. I have a friend in Rome that had three sightings as he's flying. He's a 747 pilot with Alitalia Airlines and has had three sightings while he's flying.
At least the government was looking, or pretending to look in the 60s with the Project Blue Book and the Condon Report. Now it seems like no one in government is really paying attention to this. I mean, are there any governmental agencies looking into this?
Well, you know something? I mean, they're hoping will go away. You and I and everybody that's talking about it, they're saying, well, I hope they go away. But, yes, the truth of the matter is that there are groups in the intelligence community that are very interested in this. The Vatican is very interested in this, or they would never have made that statement on May 13th, of 2009. They would have never made that statement. Why would they bother saying these things?
Well, why is the Vatican so interested in it? I mean, that doesn't make sense.
Yeah, well, it does if something's going to happen.
Oh, I see.
In other words, maybe there is a timeline to where there's an event. I don't know when the event is. I don't know how it's coming about. I have no idea. I can't predict it. But if there's an event, major, major governments and major institutions have to get in line and have an explanation. and they're covering their, you know, they're covering their area. They're saying, we told you. We said the ET is your brother and sister. We said that it is not against your religion to believe in it. You know, and this comes from official Vatican sources because it was in their newspaper. So maybe if there's an event, maybe governments will get involved in it. And then the media has to step up to the plate also, and they have to get involved in it. Mm. So,
well,
you know.
I did talk to Hal Puthoff. I interviewed him a while back, and he hinted that the government did know about it and they were putting some kind of plan in place. He didn't outright say that, but that's what I got from his remarks, you know.
Well, he's a real neat guy. I really like him, and I don't think he's at liberty to say everything, but we have some really, you know, really nice people who are involved in this behind the scenes. There is a theory, though, that, you know, a lot of the researchers are amateurs, and some, the more professionals have it handled, you know, and...
Who are the more professionals? Who would they be?
The intelligence community, the people that have all the information, the black ops people, the people that, what they call, you know, what Paul Hellyer calls the shadow government. They probably have a hell of a lot more information than we all have, and they probably figure, well, look, we got it handled. We know what we're going to do. We know what plan A, B, and C is. And the other people, you know, appear to be amateurs, and we don't have all the information. The only information I'm working from is witness testimony.
Wait, Paul Hellyer says there's a shadow government. Here's someone.
Oh, yeah, he does. He talks about it in his book.
In Canada, there's a shadow government,
no,
too?
No, no. Well, all over the world, I think it's all related. He talks about the United States, the black projects, the shadow government, the military-industrial complex, the reason why it's being kept hidden, because it's, you know, it's gone compartmentalized deep black.
Mm.
He talks about in his book. But that's what, I mean, that's also what Richard Dolan talks about. That's also what so many other researchers that have done research talk about.
Well, one of the best proofs that I think that aliens are talking to us in some way are the crop circles that are appearing every season in the south of England. I mean, that is a real phenomenon that cannot be explained with boards and planks and a couple of drunk guys in the field. You know? I mean,
well,
what do you...
I agree with you on one level, but I think that all the UFO phenomenon has a copycat phenomenon. We have back-engineered technology that looks like UFOs, and we think they're real, too. So we've got the real, and we've got the copycat. The real is still there.
Well, I'm going to get Nancy Tauber on the phone, and she has been studying this phenomena for about, I don't know, 20 years with her BLT research. And last year's season of crop circles revealed some very interesting anomalies. And she's going to report about that. I'd love to hear your comments on her report. Okay?
Well, I'd like to just listen and see what happens.
Okay. Yeah, so I'm going to get her on the phone, but thank you for all the research you've been doing. Your website, again, is paulaharris.com?
Yes, but my name is spelled P-A-O-L-A Harris. I'm Italian.
Right, and you go back and forth to Italy all the time?
Mm-hmm.
And your most recent work is promoting this interview we did with Paul Hellyer?
Exactly, mm-hmm.
I was just talking to Paula Harris, but she will be right back with Nancy Talbert, who's going to be talking about the latest 2009 report on crop circles, which will be going into the anomalies, and hopefully Paula Harris will be on the line to comment on some of these discoveries Nancy Talbert has made. Nancy Talbert's been a guest on the show a few times. Her website is bltresearch.com, and she has discovered some very interesting plant anomalies in the grains that have been taken from the crop circle. So in a way, this validates everything that Paula Harris has been talking about. Are you there?
I am.
Is Paula Harris there too?
Yes. Hi, Nancy.
Hello, Paula. How are you?
Good. It's wonderful to listen to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Nancy has five interesting points about the plant anomalies from last year's 2009 UK crop circles. So, Nancy, why don't you go into the evidence you've come across now?
All right. Now, these were all crop formations in England last summer. BLT has not been sampling in England for a couple of years because it costs every bit as much to sample a fake one as it does a real one, you know. And
right.
There are a fair number of fakes in England, so it's more productive for us generally to stay in other countries. But I thought it was about time to go back and take a good look at what was happening there. And I was kind of amazed at what we found. Last summer, for the first time, there were a consistent number of what I'm calling pictorial crop circles, meaning crop formations that looked like something that, you know, anybody could recognize. There was
a jellyfish. There was a dragonfly.
Dragonflies, birds, all kinds of things.
Right.
And my first assumption upon seeing those, there have been occasional ones in the past, you know, that looked like something. But last summer, there was a whole slew of them. And I figured that most likely, if, you know, this hoaxing thing continues, that those were going to be most likely some of the hoaxed ones. And much to my amazement, the field workers, his sampling clearly indicated that some of the ones, he didn't get to all of them, but some of these pictorial things that he got to, in particular the one called the Phoenix, and in that same field, the one you like called the Dragonfly,
right,
showed all the visible plant changes that we have been associating with the genuine article for 20 years.
Well, go through what those plant changes are so people know.
All right, this, by the way, for people listening, all of this is in a report on the BLT website. If you go to bltresearch.com, on the top of the homepage, it says 2009 British Crop Circles. If you click on that, it opens the link in this whole report with lots of photographs. It's right there, so you can follow along. What we did was what we've always done, samples from inside the formation and samples from outside, and then we compare the plants visually. And these elongated top nodes, that is the first knuckle-like protuberance along the plant stem, the first one beneath the seed head, is called the apical node. And it becomes, when these energies hit the field, elongated, stretched, because the moisture inside the plant stem is being hit by microwaves, which heats the moisture up, turning it to steam. And, of course, the steam has to escape. At the top of the plant, the fibers there are the youngest. They are the most elastic, and therefore they stretch. And it stretches to let the steam out, and when the steam is gone, what you're left with is an elongated node.
So that's
the first and perhaps most, it's the best documented physical change.
And sometimes that node is bent, too, I've noticed when I
the bending is not so significant. Bending can occur for lots of reasons, Alan. It can be significant, particularly if you are at a formation immediately after it occurs. But the natural recovery processes of the plant, which are called gravitropism and phototropism, these are the plant's natural tendencies to reorient to the sunlight and to gravity. Those cause bending at the nodes, and in young crop in particular, it sets in right away. Within a few days, the plant is already, as long as it hasn't been crushed, it's already reorienting itself to the sun and to gravity. And so if you're not there immediately after the formation occurs, and you don't know how many days have elapsed, it's very hard to evaluate that bending. So it's okay. Of secondary or tertiary importance.
But the elongation, you're saying, is a definite sign that there
the elongation of the apical node is the best documented worldwide, and consistently documented change. The second most consistently, we're talking about visible now. There are things we can do in the laboratory, but you can't see them in the field. I mean, you don't see these signs. I'm talking now only about the visible changes. The second best documented and most reliable visible plant change are these holes blown out farther down the plant stem that we call expulsion cavities.
Right.
You've seen pictures of those, I'm sure.
I have,
now,
yeah.
What's happening there is exactly the same thing as what caused the elongation at the top. The nodes are, a lot of the moisture inside the plant stem is collected at the nodes. As it is exposed to the microwaves, it turns to steam. Farther down the plant stem, the fibers are pretty tough. They're not elastic. They don't stretch. What happens is the steam builds up, and it reaches a certain point, and boom, it just pops a hole, right through the fibers at the nodes.
That's what you call
so
a blown node,
both of those
right?
changes are relative or related to exposure to microwave radiation.
Right. And do they occur in every crop circle, these blown nodes?
No, the expulsion cavities do not appear necessarily in every authentic formation. It seems to depend on the amount of moisture inside the plant stem at the time the formation occurs. It also depends on the intensity level of the microwaves in that particular plasma discharge.
Okay.
And this varies from case to case. So in older crop, which is drier to begin with, expulsion cavities generally are less frequent. You just don't have as much moisture inside the plant to begin with. Secondly, we know from looking at hundreds and hundreds of these things for years that the microwave component of this energy system is not the same in every formation. And in fact, it's not necessarily the same throughout even one formation if it's a fairly large one. So
okay.
There are a number of factors that have to be kept in your mind when you're trying to evaluate these things visually. A third visual sign is this bending, usually down at the lower nodes of the plants. And again, that is only important if you know when the formation occurred. If you are there within the first couple of days after it formed and you see a distinct marked bending at the nodes, then it is likely related to the actual formation process. However, if you were to go into a field and let's say a formation has been, it's early in the year, it's in June, and the formation has been there for a couple of weeks and you see node bending, you have absolutely no way of knowing at that point whether the node bending is the plant naturally recovering or whether it occurred during the formation process itself.
Oh, okay.
That
okay.
makes sense?
So I get that, and those are the major visible signs about a crop circle. That
there's one more sign, one more visible plant sign, and this one is only useful when you are visiting a crop circle several weeks after it occurred. And that is the development of the seed heads. When formations occur, particularly earlier on in the season, when the seed is not fully formed, if the microwave component of this energy system is intense enough, it can often completely stop the development of those seed heads. And so if you're visiting that formation 3 weeks, 4 weeks, or more after it happened, and you notice that all of the seed heads in the downed crop are much smaller than the seed heads in the controls, that's another very clear sign that this microwave energy component was present.
Okay. I understand. Those are very convincing signs. Any comment on that, Paula?
No, I'm just so happy that somebody like Nancy is working in this area because it helps us so much with credibility. I mean, when the scientists get involved, then you know, we have some real data.
Yes, yeah. And something, one of the things I wanted to bring up, this is, it's so difficult. You know, in England in particular, the people there, their educational system in the high school era years is much better than ours. Those mm-hmm. kids learn an enormous amount of mathematics compared to what we do here in the United States. And so in England, there is a strong interest in looking at the crop circles primarily from a mathematical or a geometrical point of view. And they produce some very interesting, you know, some of these people have produced some very interesting results. But if you don't take into account whether or not the circle you are trying to interpret is real, then all of the work of the interpretation, you know, this geometric analysis, blah, 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 can just as easily be on a man-made formation which was made by someone who deliberately incorporated these geometric relationships. In other words, you're doing nothing but re-examining or taking apart the careful work of some hoaxer. And I have never understood why the Brits in particular weren't a little bit more invested in trying to understand how to tell a genuine one from a fake one before they go ahead and apply this real talent that they have for looking at the geometric relationships and the mathematical relationships in many of the crop circles that occur. I mean, the hoaxers, they hang out in the pubs where all the circle people do. They hear what all the circle people are talking about, and it appears that many of them are entirely capable of then designing formations which fit the expectations that they hear the crop circle people talking about. And so it would seem to me you would want to know first whether the formation was real before you went about worrying about what it might be trying to say. Because right. if it's in fact man-made, whatever it's saying is not particularly significant.
Right. All right, so let's get to those other points that you sent me, which is also
okay.
that there was
well, the first thing was the fact that we did find that some of these pictorial formations, you know, did show all the visible bells and whistles, which really blew me away. I didn't expect that. The second thing that had a beautiful example of this last year, and almost everybody who's involved with the circle seriously has had their own experience of this sort of thing. And in this case, what we're talking about is the possibility that there is some sort of consciousness external to the individuals involved present in the crop circle situation.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Some
really?
Sort of a guiding, you know, what?
No, I was just wondering what you mean by a presence of a consciousness. I mean,
well, the idea that instead of this being a completely spontaneous, naturally functioning energy system, like a plasma discharge, is it possible that, yes, plasma is involved, but that this plasma is somehow rather directed or engineered by a consciousness of some sort? Some
I mean,
people
feel a consciousness, they're aware, they're psychically, intuitively of a presence, is what you're saying?
Again?
You're saying they're intuitively aware of a presence. Is
there are many things which occur in the fields which make you raise that question. And
uh-huh.
the next part of the report talks about one of those incidents. Two colleagues of mine from Europe, both men, both highly skeptical and very careful, very cautious in the fields, but people have been in the fields for a good 15 years now, had an experience which is very typical of hundreds of others that I know, but I included it this time because it was very pertinent. They were walking along one of these field tracks, and they had just come from that dragonfly formation, that incredibly complicated one. They had never seen a formation like that before, The lay on the ground was very different from what they were used to, and they were pretty confused, frankly. They didn't know what to make of it, and neither one of these guys likes not knowing what to make of it. And so as they were walking, they were talking between the two of them. They were completely alone out in this field. And they were saying how nice they thought it would be if one of the old-fashioned, more simple ones would appear. But they wanted some sort of a sign that would indicate, you know, that the simple one was occurring in response to their request. And so they said, well, they'd like this simple design to have a section, a ring section, that stuck out from the rest. Those are the words they used. And they wanted one of the internal standing areas to look like a slice of cake or pie.
Did they say this out loud? Did they say this consciously out loud?
They're just talking to each other as they're walking along the side of the field.
Okay.
I mean, they're not screaming it out to the wind. They're having a discussion.
Right. Okay, I get it.
There's nobody else present. They think nothing of it. They, you know, get back to their car and they get on to, I don't know, dinner or whatever the next thing was they were going to do, and essentially pretty much forgot all about it. Well, the next morning, in exactly the place where they had been in the field, the Phoenix formation occurred.
Right.
Now, the Phoenix wasn't simple, and the Phoenix didn't have this funny ring thing sticking out, nor did it seem to have anything in it that looked like a slice of cake.
Right.
It was another pictorial one like the dragonfly. But it happened at exactly the location where they had been when they were having this discussion. And then on the following day, the day after that, in another location not very far away, a place called Milk Hill, darned if this formation that seemed to be a reflection of exactly what they were asking for did appear. And it was a much simpler, more old-fashioned looking kind of crop circle made up of some circles and rings. And in one section, the ring is clearly sticking out abnormally from the rest of the design. It doesn't fit with the geometry. And within the circle, there is this very clear standing what looks like a triangle, you know, like a slice of pie.
Well, often now, it seems like whoever's making these crop circles do respond to human consciousness. I know when I was there in 2008, I was there for August 8, 2008, the 888, and me and Jaime Musan, a bunch of people, were camped out knowing that there was a formation that was going to appear that day, with just that intuitive sense, and we did get a formation on 888, and it was the figure 8. But it was more than just an 8. It was a kind of complex Mobius strip type of 8. So they were in touch with this, I feel, aspect of human consciousness. They gave us what we were thinking, and they gave us more. So there's a kind of dialogue sometimes that seems to happen with human consciousness.
Well, in the case of the 8, which I know which one you're speaking of,
right,
it wasn't sampled, so I have no idea personally whether it was real or not. But in the case of this one with my two colleagues, it was sampled, and every single one of these physical signs that we looked for was present.
Mm.
Now, there are literally hundreds of stories, many of them quite reliable, by people who have spent considerable time in the fields where, you know, they have meditated upon a particular design, or they've drawn one secretly and put it in, you know, letter and mailed it to someone to keep, you know, or they've just thought of it briefly in their mind, or whatever. And then a circle will come that absolutely seems to reflect, you know, what it was they were thinking about. And
Yes. This
has encouraged many people to think about the possibility that whatever is doing this is in fact conscious.
Yeah, I think it obviously is, and they seem to be dialoguing with us telepathically. Like Paula Harris was saying, there's a kind of telepathic element to contact. So
it very well may be. I don't know. I don't know whether that is the final, will be understood finally as correct. But I have myself seen so many indications of it, I'm not going to be surprised at all if that's what it turns out to be. My personal experiences are so repeated now that I have trouble staying objective when I hear these stories, because it's happened so many times to me. But, I mean, what the point I'm making here is simply that there are many, many indicators by many reliable people, people with no particular axe to grind and with no original interest in having it be this or that, which seems to indicate not only a consciousness that is aware generally, but one that is aware of them specifically and in a timely manner. As if, in other words, it literally can hear people's conversations and then act them out.
Hey, now, Paula, what do you think of that, Paula? Of that idea?
What do I think? I think it's very viable. I've talked to Colin Andrews about some of the situations, and he said there's been cases of hoaxers that are starting a crop circle, and they don't finish it, and the next day they wake up, and it's been finished by someone,
and not them.
It's finished. In other words, from nowhere, it's finished. So, yeah, this idea of consciousness, I think that there are a lot more people are writing about and speaking about consciousness is very important.
Right. Well, there are more people having the experiences, and in the beginning, the first, I don't know, 5 or 10 of these experiences that I had, I was inclined to write off as, you know, interesting coincidence. But there gets to be a point among even the most stubborn of us, you know, where you're just, it's harder to come up with that kind of an explanation than it is to just go with the flow. Like, hell no, something that is conscious was aware, and that something is directly related to making the crop circles. Now, of course, the question then becomes who or what, and there's a huge range of opinions about, you know, whether this could be an ET presence or an interdimensional presence or a spiritual presence or an earth energy presence. I mean, you know, it goes on and on and on, and I don't know. But there is a growing body of evidence that consciousness of some kind is, in fact, involved at least part of the time, if not all.
Maybe so it's all of the above. Is that possible? Could it be all of it?
As far as I know. You know about as much as I do when it comes to this.
Well, that's the name of my last book anyway, because I remember being asked if the UFO phenomenon was interdimensional, interplanetary, paranormal, and I think it's all of it. It's all of the above. It's not either or. It's a whole other level that we're studying.
Right. It does seem to come from another level of awareness that we have even yet to consider. All we can do is call it spiritual or interdimensional, but
I think it's better that we not call
none
it
of that.
I think it's better that we leave it open and keep paying attention very carefully and documenting very carefully and leaving this business of creating pigeonholes with names on the pigeonholes into which you stick each new event is very limiting. The minute you've labeled something, you've stopped thinking very openly about it. And until we have absolute proof of any of these ideas, I frankly think it's much wiser to report it accurately and in as great depth as you can. And you can express your personal conviction, but make sure that you clarify when you do that, that it is a personal conviction rather than some scientific proof. Because this then allows other people to have their own thoughts, their own opinions, their own ideas about it, you see?
I do agree, and it keeps the field open. I mean, it's just human tendency to say, oh, it's this or this or this, but we have to be aware.
People want answers because it makes them nervous when they don't have them.
Right. So we have to be aware that it might not be anything we think it is.
I think
even
so.
There's another
very interesting discovery that occurred that is covered in this report also. Off and on over the years, there are farmers in England who are getting pretty fed up, you know, with these circles all the time. And a few of these farmers have taken recently to cutting the circles out as soon as they occur. If they hear about them, they go right into the field and just take them out. And this happened last summer, many times, much more frequently than in the past. And in all of those cases, another circle would appear either the next night or within, say, two or three nights, either directly adjacent to the one that had been cut out, or maybe 50 yards away, or maybe in the field absolutely right next, looking as if whatever was doing it was not at all pleased with their first attempt being cut out, and was therefore coming right back and doing it again. And I have wondered ever since this started whether it was possible that the first one that was cut out was genuine, and whether the second one was, because it could just as easily be two made by hoaxers, you know? Happened that my guy happened to get there to a place called Winterbourne Basset, where a circle had occurred on one particular morning, one night, and the farmer found it the crack of dawn and cut it out almost immediately. 2 days later, 50 yards away, bam, in the same field, here comes another one. And my guy just happened to get there on that morning. So he went into this second formation looking for all these physical signs and did, in fact, find them in the second formation. Then he walked up the tram lines into what had been the first formation. Now, in this case, the farmer had only lopped off the heads of the crop, and so the bottom two or three nodes were still in the field. And guess what? He found the expulsion cavities throughout that one in those bottom two or three nodes. Then he walked and looked at the standing crop in between those two formations. It was only about 50 yards separating them. And lo and behold, the standing plants, now these are plants that have never been flattened, all showed exactly the same changes.
Even though they were still standing, they had changed.
Both of those formations were real, and the amount of energy expended was enough so that there was a spillover effect that affected the standing stuff in between the two formations.
I see.
And that to me is a sign. The way I interpreted that was that the agency behind this is becoming a little more assertive, not as willing as it may have been once to simply be obliterated and forgotten. Now, John Burke would say, no, the reason the second one came down right next to the first one was that you had a very strong ground electrical charge there, and there was simply another one of these naturally occurring plasmas in the area, and therefore it was drawn down to the same position.
Well, that was something I never agreed with John Burke about, naturally forming plasmas. There's probably a ground electrical charge, though, that pulls the plasma to the earth to create the formation.
Well, John and I did an enormous amount of ground electrical charge measurements, and we know, at least in southern England, that the ground electrical charge does increase as the summer goes along and as the water table drops, which it does during the summer. And what this means is that the surface water from rains has to travel farther to get down to the water table itself, and the electrons are stripped off the water, and this causes an increase in the ground electrical charge. We also know, of course, that there tend to be more crop circles as the summer progresses when the ground electrical charge is greater. Now, if an atmospheric plasma is the cause of this, whether a naturally occurring one or a generated one, if you like, in either case, the change in the ground electrical charge would function as an attractor.
Right. I agree with that this seems to be some kind of attractor, particularly in that part of England.
You've got this huge chalk aquifer, you have the most porous rock in the world underlies all of that land. And because of the porosity of the rock, the water as it goes down through the chalk, these electrons are stripped off, and you can measure. It's very easy to do, and we spent several years doing it and did find that, in fact, the ground electrical charge increases as the summer goes along.
Now, the reason it would be done with such a powerful ground electric charge would mean it would facilitate more complex designs to be made more easily.
No, more simply that it would function as an attractor to such a system. Mm-hmm. And whether the system was completely spontaneously generated by nature or whether it was manufactured, if you will, in some way, it wouldn't matter. I mean, once the plasma had been created, it would respond in the same way if there was a strong attractor in the area.
I mean, one of the things people forget is that the crop circles left vortices of energy in the Earth.
Along things called waveguides. And a very well-known waveguide in ball lightning is attracted to chimneys. We all know this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the chimney is nothing more than a waveguide. And these tram lines in the fields are essentially, they're not four-sided rectangles, they're three-sided, but they function the same way as waveguides to these microwaves once they're in the area.
Anyway, I did hear that the vortexes of plasma that was left in the fields did have a powerful effect on the Earth and the people who came to those pieces of land. And actually, the Earth itself is affected by these plasma formations.
I don't know exactly what you mean by affected. You'd have to be a little more precise about that.
Well, it means that it leaves a particular charge that affects the whole field of the Earth itself, including humans. This is what someone who's looking at it from a psychic point of view said. So it's actually amping up our vibrational field, if you want to call it that.
I don't know a great deal about that area. I think that's more your arena than mine.
Well, it's not scientific in the way that you're studying it, but it just suggests there's other things that possibly could be taking place more than that we can measure at this time. But why don't you go on to your fifth point about the Winterbourne Basset Formation and the two formations that were formed there.
All right, well, the only other major thing that's included in this report is the fact that we found these expulsion cavities and elongated nodes running along the tram lines in between the two formations at Winterbourne Basset. And not only did we find them running along the tram lines or the tractor lines, you know, that they use for spray in the field, and in those tractor lines which intersected the two formations, there were many, many of these expulsion cavities and elongated nodes. And we also found them up to a considerable distance away on the other side. In other words, on the extreme out north and extreme south of the two formations, quite a distance away from the formations themselves, again emphasizing the likelihood that the tractor lines themselves are functioning as waveguides and carrying the microwaves along and affecting then the plants along the edges of the tram lines.
Now this is a new phenomena in crop circle research. Is that true?
This is new documentation. This effect was proposed by John Burke actually years ago. This is the first time we've documented it as carefully as we did. And we're going to do more. I mean, we didn't do as much of this as I wish we could have, but we're going to be doing some more of it. But it clearly supports this whole idea that microwave radiation is involved. This is not planks and boards and, you know, the pranks with planks thing going on. This is something else. One of the energies involved is certainly microwave radiation. Mm-hmm. And this is not emanating. I happen to disagree, and with all due respect to Dr. Jacques Vallée, the idea that this is microwave weaponry being tested is, in my opinion, absurd.
Right.
Not least because such microwave weaponry, if it did exist, would literally cook these poor tourists who are out in the fields of southern England all the time. I don't think that the idea that weaponry being tested could possibly be the answer, not least because we know that crop circles have existed at the very least since the beginning of the 1900s. We didn't have any microwave weaponry back in 1900, and yet we've got tons of crop circles.
But,
so,
but 2009 was a revolutionary year for these pictorial forms, for the complexity of the shapes, and for some of the stuff that you've just noted about the kind of in-between, the plants in-between formations.
Well, the tram line information, the stuff about it running along, we have found in the past on many occasions that standing crop has been affected, particularly standing crop inside. You know, some of the formations are made up of sections inside that stand up. And in many of those cases, we have found exactly the same thing, which immediately rules out the hoaxer's argument, because they're saying that the plant changes we're talking about are caused by flattening the plants.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're finding them in plants that aren't flattened, I kind of think that wrecks that argument, doesn't it?
Yeah. So is there anything new in the development, else new in the development of the crop circle phenomena? Because there seems to be a growing complexity in the forms. And
you are bloody intuitive, aren't you?
In which way?
Well, I can't tell you about it yet because we don't have it. We're not positive. But we think that, yes, there is something else new that's happening. And we're right in the middle of some studies to prove it. I don't like talking about things like this until we know, until we can show. But, yes, it appears that there are things continuing to evolve in the situation. It doesn't seem to me to be sitting still. It's continuing to do more stuff, you know?
Oh, yeah. Could you give us a little hint about what that could be? Because you said there were some strange anomalies when the plant seeds were cultivated.
No, not until the work is done. It's just stupid to go out there and talk about something until you know what you're talking about.
Okay.
And I don't doing that. I'd rather stick with the facts when we've got them.
Okay, well, you'll have to come back on the show for that. But the 2010 season is upon us. There's been some very solid, at least four solid formations so far in rapeseed canola in that part of England. And the last one that came up was a very precise mathematical formula. It just happened the other day. Anything to say about those formations?
Well, number one, the four in England that you're speaking, there are four in Italy also, and there's one in Germany right now.
Oh,
but
there
the
is.
The four in England that you're talking about are all in this canola plant, a rapeseed.
Right.
And the field reports in rapeseed, because the stalk is so thick, it breaks like celery very easily. And so any mechanical pressure will cause not only the breakage, but it scrapes off the bloom on the stalk of the plant. And if you are the first person to get to a formation in rapeseed, you could certainly tell immediately whether or not it had been made with a board or a plank. We're trying very hard to get the people in England, because there are many people out in the fields looking for these things now, to write down the exact time that they enter, the day and the time that they enter what they think is a new formation. Because in rapeseed, once one person has been in, you can no longer tell, because any walking in it will cause this breakage, you see.
I see.
And so unless we know exactly when the thing occurred and who was the first person in, it's almost impossible to say with any certainty at all whether the thing was man-made or not. Now, so far they haven't quite got it together, but I think the four or five people who are most likely to be in first have all gotten this point now, and I think the reports from here on in will be reflecting the day and the time that they entered and took their photographs or did whatever, which is absolutely critical if you're trying to determine whether there was damage, you know, before they got in.
Right. Well, let me ask you, there's rapeseed, and then the seasoning goes into barley and wheat. When does that start to appear?
The barley will come, it's already in the ground, and as soon as it's grown, now there was a fairly cold winter last year, so the rape is slightly behind, a week or so behind normal, and the barley will then also be, the whole season will be a little bit later than it was the year before.
Oh,
but
I see.
Within a couple of weeks, I think, we'll start to see them in barley. And then after that, for the rest of the summer, they're mostly in wheat because the barley gets harvested, you see.
Right. Okay, so they're in wheat then for the rest of the summer. So any predictions that you just want to make for 2010, the 2010 season, anything that you would like to see or suspect might be seen since you've been studying this for as long as anyone?
I'm not good at the predicting bit. Well, I know that the phenomenon is evolving, and I just hope that however it evolves this summer, it gives us a few more clues as to what in the heck is going on. It's exhausting to do this work for so many years and still not know exactly what it is that's going on.
Well, actually, no, I'm going to be taking people, or I'm going to be bringing people to England sometime in the middle of June to check out this phenomena. And if people want to come, they can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net if they want to check it out for themselves and be part of, I would call, a miraculous phenomena. Really, a truly one of the great mysteries on planet Earth. I mean, UFOs come and go, but these formations stay throughout the season. So,
now, one of the beauties of the formations, of course, is that they're physical and they sit there, and anybody can see them, and anybody who is paying attention and careful can observe all sorts of things. And it is true that some formations affect physically or energetically people. And in different ways, I mean, different people have different responses to different formations, but almost anybody who has spent any time in the fields will have had at least a few formations where they've had very strong physical reactions that clearly were caused by being in the circle.
I have to say, I felt very dizzy the first circle I went in 2008. And then as I
now, have you ever been out in the fields in the sun before? Because that can do it, you know.
No, I walked around a particular spiral, which was part of the 2012 formation, and that something in that got me dizzy. No, I've been out in the fields.
No, I mean, I'm not making fun of you. It's that many city people have never been out in the wind and the sun in the fields for any length of time, and some of them get overcome simply because they're not used to that amount of air and sun. And it takes a couple of days to acclimate before they feel normal again, you know?
That could be, but I did feel different things in different circles that were real subtle shifts in my moods even. So some of this is inexplainable. People have talked about
feeling. In Holland last summer, in one of the formations that occurred there, in fact, it occurred while I was en route in the air. I was somewhere over the Atlantic when it appeared. And when I got to the ground, we went very quickly to the place where it was, so it was quite new. And I haven't had a strong physical reaction in a crop circle for a number of years, but in that one, my leg, my right thigh, began to burn so intensely that I had to finally leave the field that first day. I could not stay in it. And once I was out for a while, it was okay, and each trip we made back after that, the effect lessened. And finally, at the end of my stay several weeks later, I could go in the formation without any problem at all. But that first, oh my God, that first day, that burned. It was only in the outer right thigh, and I mean, I've never felt anything like that. Very intense. And
that
what in the world that means, I don't know.
Hey, Paula, do you have any more questions for Nancy? Any comments?
Yeah, I do. Nancy, one of the reasons I've stayed away from the whole crop circle phenomenon, I was very good friends with Eljo Hesselhoff initially. He worked with Phillips, and he did that kind of, you know, analysis that you do also. And it was wonderful to see scientists involved. But I got so confused with the fake ones and the real ones. Do you think we will ever have a book where people that go over to England get, you know, on one chapter,
all they have
you know,
to do
site, we'll
is go to
ones?
Our website. It's all right there.
You mean you have the real ones and fake ones on your website?
Well, you don't. I have all of the ways to decide. I mean, it's very clear. There's no. We were never interested in, it was not our purpose to function as a clearinghouse to tell people this one's real, this one isn't. I mean, that's, you know, to us that seemed like a silly thing. We're trying to learn what's going on. And by showing you the clear physical signs that have been documented and now published in the scientific literature, and therefore are accepted facts until somebody comes along and publishes a paper that says that we're crazy, I mean proves that we're crazy, those are the physical signs to look for, and that's what the whole website is pretty much devoted to.
Yeah, but a lot of these tours are going to also to ones where you don't know whether they
are. Well, then
they're
just
going
to have to live with not knowing.
Oh, I mean, okay, well, that's...
There is no God walking the earth who's going to be able to tell you about all of them.
No, but it's not about that. The ones that are making them could say, we made these.
But they don't want to tell you that.
But
the people who
Nancy,
are making them,
Nancy's
some of them do it to fool you
Nancy's
on purpose. Some of them apparently do it because they consider it art.
They do.
I suspect that there's some people doing it to deliberately confuse the whole situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. But I think what you're saying, Nancy, is if you go to the circles and look for the signs you outline on your website, people themselves will be able to tell if this is genuine or not.
I don't think I can look for notes.
They'll have some information.
Yeah, but I can't look for notes. I can't do the scientific behind
it. You could look
for
notes.
Notes
are easy to find. Tell her how easy they are to notice the notes.
All you do when you go into the formation is you have your little penknife. And you cut off a handful of standing plants some considerable distance away from the formation. These are your controls. You then walk into the formation, get down on your hands and knees, and start comparing the nodes on your controls to the nodes on the plants you see flattened all around you. And you do it in various sections of the formation. Look for the expulsion cavities. If they're there, I mean, they're obvious. You don't need glasses to see them. They're clear as a bell. The node elongation is very easy. You take the top nodes of your control plants, and you hold them next to the top nodes of the flattened plants. Are they longer or not?
Yeah.
You know, this is not rocket science, and it takes a little bit of time. It takes a little effort. But these are the physical signs that are available. The only other way to tell, we do a lot of germination work and, you know, other things that require microscopes, but there are multiple signs that I have just outlined in this report that make it, they are the visible signs that you can use to help yourself know whether or not you're in one that is man-made or not.
And that's as good as the science can give you right now. That people can tell for themselves.
I think also part of what makes this a valuable situation is the experience of the mysterious, the unknown. You know, this is part of what the crop circles are all about, I think, just waking people up and opening their minds to the possibility of things beyond what we know as reality. It's stretching our heads. And I think that's part of the value of going to see the crop circles.
Well, I think
some
that's also what the UFO phenomena has done and what researchers like Paula Harris has done to show people that something else is possible that we have yet to consider.
Yeah, reality.
No, I mean, crop circles are part of it, and I agree with you. It doesn't matter if they're real or not. It's just that with my kind of work, I'd have to go... I mean, I'd have to go to the real thing because that's, you know, I'd like to know more there than, maybe I should learn about the esoteric part, because from what I understand, there's experiences also with the man-made ones.
I don't think that's true, but that's just my opinion.
Yeah,
well,
I don't think that's
true either,
but... One
of the reasons that I spend as much time in other countries
I think it is important if they're real, because if they are real, it means there is an intelligence that's communicating us through symbols that are affecting our conscious and subconscious minds. That's my take on the situation.
I kind of think the whole phenomenon is, if nothing else, if it is not doing anything else at all, it is providing an opportunity for people to begin to think about, in a very gentle, very unobtrusive, non-threatening manner, the idea that reality is much larger than most people think it is. And that's one of the things I love about them. I think that they're a gentle invitation to think about some of these things, rather than a frightening way, you know, to force people into thinking.
Well, I have to say
that
is sort of a difference between the alien UFO phenomena and the crop circle phenomena. Within the alien world, is sort of an eeriness, a kind of creepy feeling to that phenomena, if that's real. But in the crop circles, you feel more of a lightness, a more uplifting energies. That's been my experience having
Arecibo Reply and Crabwood.
And they were both probably man-made.
You
think
so?
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's a lot of weirdness there, too. It's like, it's all part of it. I think it's all part of it. It's all part of the mystery.
Well, the part that interests me is the true phenomenon. I am not interested in the man-made stuff. I'm interested in what the real phenomenon is and what its purpose is. And I personally think its purpose is to, in a gentle and continually persuasive manner, encourage ordinary people to think about larger aspects of reality. That if nothing else, is what they're supposed to be doing. I think some of them do encode precise information for people with expertise in certain areas, but I don't think you need to be a rocket scientist or anything else to get the basic message, which is wake up, pay attention, look around you.
Consider the basic
likelihood of many, many aspects to reality existing that you've never really thought about before. The problem with UFOs is that they often scare the dickens out of people. And I don't think approaching the idea of a larger reality with fear is the way to get most people paying attention. I mean, unless you scare them half to death. And I don't think that's a wise idea either.
Well, I think both phenomena is worth investigating, because it is part of the unknown that we need to be open to. So,
I think so, it's
coming to at us in all different ways. Yes, maybe crop circles are easier to deal with because it's a gentler effect, but, you know, we can't deny the fact that
maybe what we're seeing is representation of many different consciousnesses from different sources, some of which may be interdimensional, some of which may be spiritual, some of which may be extraterrestrial. And it appears to be limitless what could be possible, and it may be that these different the different phenomena represent different cultures or different species, or, you know, what, I don't know, different critters, you know?
Or different realities or dimensional space. I mean, yes, the possibility is infinite, but I do think we will have an answer at some point. It just feels like something's being revealed. It's another form of disclosure or contact or...
Yeah, it does seem to me that it's amping up each year, as the UFO thing seems to be doing, you know, on many different levels. And maybe we're going to live long enough to have some serious grasp of what all of this means. If not, somebody recently said to me, you best keep a good, strong sense of humor, because maybe the whole thing is just some marvelous cosmic joke, and you want to be able to have some fun with it, if nothing else.
Well, I think it's part of it. I don't know if it's all a cosmic joke, but it's definitely, you know, something that seems to be uplifting our spirits on all levels. That's my feeling. Thank
Robert
you both.
Robert Vandenbroek is absolutely of that opinion. I mean, he is convinced that at least the circles that are happening around him and all these other strange things are of a spiritual reality that is attempting to touch base, you know, with humanity. So, I don't know.
Your
I think keep
Robert,
an open mind. Don't make pigeonholes. Don't label everything. Don't decide you understand or know what blah, blah, blah means. Keep your mind open and keep looking. And
hey,
if we do that, and if enough of us do it, we may eventually really learn something.
Tell Paula about the guy you're working with, Robert, in Holland a little bit.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to Nancy about that because we had met at the International UFO Congress, and we sat down, and I think we had coffee, and I'm really curious about that, if you feel like talking about it.
Sure. I mean, there's a whole page devoted to him on the website and some of the events. I'm finishing a report now on the photographs of people who have died that he takes. But Robert, since he was a child,
of people who have died on digital cameras, what Nancy's saying.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make any difference whether it's digital. It can be film, or it doesn't really matter.
Okay.
But the point is that since he was a child, he has been aware of other aspects to reality. His parents didn't recognize this at first, and he went through some very difficult times with having to be examined psychologically because his parents thought perhaps he was ill. But it was eventually decided that no, he was not, that he did not suffer any psychological pathology. And now they have come to recognize that, no, he's a psychic. And they call him, he's called a medium now in Holland. And he does, you know, he sees a lot of people for readings and things of this sort. But he is convinced, the thing that's most interesting about Robert to me, and the reason why I got involved with him really, was that he's the only person anywhere, so far as I know, who knows when and where the new circles are forming as they form in his area of Holland. Mm-hmm. And he not only knows that they are forming and generally where they are, he'll know what they're going to look like. And he can draw, sit at home and draw on a piece of paper what the new circle that's forming right then is going to look like, and he'll have some idea. Sometimes he has a very specific, he knows exactly where they are. Other times he simply will know the direction that we should drive in, and we get in the car and do drive in whatever direction he says to, and begin to look for, he normally in these visions he will get something that gives him a clue as to the location, you know, a barn that's there or something, and we look for whatever those signs are. And every single time, there will be a brand new crop circle, exactly as he has described. Now, how he does this, he says he sees it in his mind's eye. He sees it very clearly as it is occurring. And he thinks that these that occur in his area are all coming from this spiritual reality, this spiritual source, which is trying to help mankind simply open their eyes to a greater truth, you know, a larger reality. And that he, for some reason, which he doesn't understand, has been pointed up to do this, you know.
Well, has he getting anything so far this season? Anything coming to him?
There haven't been any circles in Holland yet. Sometimes the first ones of the season will start there. But so far, there haven't been any reported in Holland. Probably there will be soon, but not yet. You never know. I mean, you literally never know from year to year what's going to happen. And last summer, for the first time, he started, you know, he takes these thousands and thousands of totally off-the-wall, bizarre photos. And last year, they were primarily UFO photos. I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them that he took with my camera. But I encouraged him last year when we were out in the field to not use just my camera, because he's been doing that for years. There were other people there, you know, in the fields with us, and most of them had cameras. And so over and over and over again, I asked him, I said, you know, I would talk to people and I'd tell him, you go up to that guy, that's Robert, give him your camera and stand with him, watch him, watch what he does while he uses your camera to take pictures. And I did this on purpose because I wanted to have many people observe that with their cameras, cameras Robert had never seen before, hadn't touched, that, you know, he would get these same strange photos, which he did. And so I wrote a report about that and put it up on the website fairly recently. Just dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of UFO photos taken with all these different people's cameras. Some of these people he knew, most of them he didn't. And I made very careful notes as to who they were and how to reach them afterward so I could get permission to use their photos. And then on my camera, he must have taken 400 or 500 UFO photos. You know, while I'm standing right there watching him, in a pitch-black, dark field, there's absolutely nothing there visually. He can't see anything, and I can't either, and neither did any of these other people. And yet, on the camera, here come these fabulous images.
And that's some
that's
of that's
amazing.
On your website.
What?
Those
that's on Robert's
are...
page on our website, the Vandenbroek case.
Okay.
And if you scroll down below my introduction to him, you'll see many reports about the events that go on around Robert. I mean, I've labeled them differently depending on what we're talking about, but there are a whole bunch of them down at the bottom. And soon there will be this other report about the people who have died. I mean, what I asked Robert last year about these UFO pictures, why they were UFOs happening, because normally we have always thought that UFOs really had nothing to do with the circle phenomenon at all. And yet he tells me now that some UFOs are in fact related to the crop circles, and more, he thinks that the images of the UFOs that have come on all the cameras is not necessarily because the image, the UFO itself, was so important, but that people nowadays are very familiar with the concept of UFO, and to most people, UFOs mean otherworldly. And he thinks that the images of UFOs may have been occurring simply because so many people already understand that as otherworldly.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Thank you,
Nancy. Just another way to tap people on the shoulder and say, wake up, wake up, pay attention.
Well, I think we're doing that now. I think with the work both of you are doing is just ways of telling people there's more to reality than we've suspected, and hopefully more and more people are listening. I think they are.
I think they are too, Alan, because of the efforts of, there are a lot of us, you know, in one way or the other. I mean, by having radio shows or television shows or writing books or whatever we're doing.
And conferences, yeah, the whole ExoPolitics conference was part of that. So
getting this information out, it's reaching more and more people, and more people are beginning to think, oh, well, maybe that's worth checking out. There, mm-hmm. I mean, there are always going to be people who refuse. There are many people who are really quite frightened by the idea, and I understand that. But I think we are making headway, and perhaps at some point enough of the population has begun to be serious in their consideration of these things, that it's kind of a hundredth monkey thing, you know, maybe it eventually swings everything in the direction we're hoping it does. I also think that individual thought actually has an effect on physical reality. And so the more people that we have thinking very positively about this potential, these possibilities, perhaps that actually has something to do with the eventual reality in
the
physical realm.
Well, I think it does, and I'm compelled to keep doing shows like this to put out the positive ideas that there's something talking to us. There are beings or consciousnesses that want to influence us in a positive way to get over our barbaric habits of killing each other, of war, of destruction. I mean, it's such a primitive way of acting that we really have only one choice, which is to evolve.
I hope you're right. When I think of this terrible spill in the Gulf, you know, right now.
I know, it's awful.
The instant it happened, I knew how catastrophic it was going to be. And it has absolutely amazed me at the way the media, it's taken them all this time to even begin, apparently, to think about the consequences of this. I mean, are they all stupid?
Well, I think they are a little stupid, and it's huge, the consequences to the whole ocean, which is the blood of
the planet.
You know? Yeah. No, it's awful.
It's a major horrible thing, as apparently is the pollution problem of the air and the water and the land, as is the climate change situation, as are the wars in the Mideast. God knows we need the help. If there are consciousnesses, entities that are wiser than humans, I don't see any reason, frankly, as to why we would deserve any help. But if there are positive agencies out there that have any clue as to how to teach people how to get along
better. Well, I think we do have to save ourselves, though, and it seems like, you know, maybe these crises are bringing us to a point where we're realizing that. So we do seem to be getting assistance, but it's really up to us.
I'm sure ultimately it's up to us, and that means then getting more and more people aware of the various realities we've encountered and know, you know, exist, even if we don't understand exactly what they mean. You don't have to give people the answer. Yeah. The point here is to get people asking the right questions. Right. And I think that's what I think most of my work is geared toward. It's simply trying to provide a solid enough base so that intelligent people, if they read, you know, get the foundation, are then impelled on their own to ask questions about, well, what does this all mean? And in so doing, reflect upon, you know, humanity and culture and how we've developed and what needs to be fixed. I think there are more and more people doing it, and I just hope that I'm assisting a little bit.
You absolutely are, and so is Paula Harris's research. So thank you both.
And lots and lots of other people, I think.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both. You know, Nancy, now that I have you here, I think there should be more women in the field, too. I mean, you know, I really respect your work a lot, and I've, you know, followed it the best I can. Now I'm going to really go on your website and research everything. But for the longest time, it's been a heavily male field, and I'd like to encourage more women to go into this.
Yeah, women the male ego gets in the way a bit, you know. Some men's. Now, this is not at all true of Ellen. But are, without question, men who have been involved who want to then own whatever it is, you know, that they're paying attention to. And I know, boy, do I know that none of us own this stuff. Whatever this is that's going on, it's way beyond any one of us coming close to owning it. You know, it is a very complex, powerful, unbelievably layered situation. And what we need is to all cooperate as much as we possibly can if we're ever going to get close to an answer. I mean, this business of people walking around acting as if they're the grand poobahs of whatever, it's silly. I mean, we've only scratched the surface of whatever all this is.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your research, Nancy. Your website is
ELT. Thank you for your time and effort, and yours too, Paula.
Well, thank you. We're all in this together.
Right.
You better believe it.
Well,
talk to you later.
Your research is BLTResearch.com. Nancy
Correct.
Taub, And Paula Harris is Paula, P-A-O-L-A, Harris.com.
Right. Thank you.
Easy to remember. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you. And my name's Alan Steinfeld. And again, if you're interested in checking out the Crop Circles this summer, email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And we're planning a tour sometime in June.
And Alan, there is a listing on our website of all the American crop circles on the BLT site.
Good. We will go there.
Good luck on your trip.
Thank you. I'll be in touch with you both, and maybe at the end of the season we'll do another report.
All righty.
Okay, Nancy. If people want to find out more about some of the other interviews I've done with UFO researchers, it's on my website, newrealities.com, under X-Files podcast, and also here on bbsradio.com, their archive. Thank you for listening, and I'm going to end with this Neil Young song.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceships flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen ones. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seat to a